Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the United States of Anxiety.
Cool, so can I ask you all a question?
A show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
Tell me your name and what show or anything, any piece of art that's inspired you in the pandemic times.
What really inspired me was Pose, because it made me realize that we're getting better as an industry when it comes to LGBTQ representation.
It was Deanna Lawson. She's a photographer, and she just captures Black love, Black people, of all diasporas.
I just got one word, Donda.
Well, now I was incarcerated for 2 years, so the whole pandemic I was like locked up. So seeing people create little cloths into like great portraits of people's family is like amazing for me, and that's what people use to pass the time during the pandemic.
I watched a whole lot of comedy. People were able to get people to think about a situation, and that's something that I've seen definitely pick up throughout the 2020s.
The truth goes down a little easier with a laugh, I guess. And, you know, there is apparently really some science to that old saying, too, that laughter is the best medicine. So perhaps some of you laughed your way through these painful past couple of years. Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. And this week, we are thinking about the arts, from comedy to TV to museums to books, theater. The Tony Awards are going to be on tonight, right after our show. I was at an opening for an art exhibit last night in Newburgh, New York. I actually ran into some of our listeners. Shouts to our United States of Anxiety peeps in Newburgh. Anyway, the event was for a photo project documenting Newburgh's Black history, and it kind of led to a hard conversation. There were a bunch of folks there, all I gathered well-meaning and genuinely wanting to build together, but coming at it from very different walks of life across race and gender and class, city officials to art students. And the discussion got hard. There were questions about who gets to tell Black stories and why they're telling them. And what does it really actually mean to be in community when people have wildly different resources and privileges? I've been chewing on it all day. And it's just a reminder of the way art, creative work, can nudge us into the hard stuff. Get us to wrestle in new and often deeply personal ways with the questions about how we share space and resources in this country. So that's what we're talking about tonight. And I've got a straightforward question for you all to get us started. What's one creative work you've taken in during these hard months of the pandemic that inspired you in some way? However you take that word, inspired, it, and in any medium of creativity, it could be TV, film, theater, dance, books, just whatever. What's one work that has inspired you and why? 646-435-7280. That's 646-435-7280. Or tweet us using the hashtag US of Anxiety. Before the show, we've already gotten a bunch of tweets just to sort of give you a flavor of what's starting. Someone, Tara Anderson, just posted a GIF of RuPaul's Drag Race. So I think that falls under comedy, pushing us into sometimes some harder questions than we can normally ask each other. Bluebird Mountaineer tweeted, Dixon on Apple TV inspired me to journal and be okay living in my head, which provided me a respite from the chaos of the world. It also reminded me that issues during that period are still relevant today and lots of creative ways to uplift others. So I don't know that show, but I'll have to check it out. And as we take your calls, I am so happy to be joined by someone who's both watching the creative world as a critic and creating art herself. Morgan Jerkins is the senior culture editor at ESPN's The Undefeated, and she's published not one, but two books in the course of the pandemic. Her most recent work is a novel, Call Baby, and it came out in April. Morgan, thanks for joining us and congrats on all that creation.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. I'm excited to chop it up with you.
All right. So what was it like? I mean, both making and releasing work in the middle of this pandemic.
Oh, chaotic. I think it was very, very chaotic. The interesting thing about it was my second book, Wandering Strange Lands, was supposed to come out, I think it was May 2020. And I think it was probably a week after I had to go home, in terms of like, I couldn't go to the office anymore. I got an email from my editor saying, hey, can we actually push your book back to August? And I'm like, sure, please. That's totally fine. Because, you know, I lived in New York. I lived in the epicenter of the virus. And I was shell-shocked. I was living by myself at the time. So I was like, that's totally fine. But then at the same time, I was also trying to hit the finish line with edits on my third book, Call Baby. And when I was doing that, that's when the protest happened in June.
George
Floyd. It was my birthday month. George Floyd protests. It was my birthday month. And it was also 8 p.m. curfew. So hearing sirens, hearing just blood-curdling levels of fireworks, it was a lot. Even though I still had the space to create, because I was lucky enough, fortunate to work from home, it was very hard to be imaginative in certain parts of the beginning parts of the pandemic, because just being surrounded by so much loss, I think. And yet at the same time, I was absorbing so much content like everyone else. Like sometimes I'll be on Twitter and I'll be like, did this come out during the pandemic? And then I realized how long the pandemic has been because of certain TV shows.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you are a Black woman who is a writer who has created all of this work. I think it's important to note. And it feels like, even with all that as a backdrop, it feels like all that trauma that you were describing as a backdrop, it feels like we're in a renaissance, I use that word lightly, but a renaissance moment for Black creators, certainly book authors. I know a lot of friends and colleagues who finally got the book deals they deserved long ago, but really in every medium, this has been a seeming explosion of access for Black creators. Both as a writer and a critic, I wonder, I mean, do you agree with that statement, first off?
I agree with it, but I also say it with a bit of apprehension. The reason why is because I do admit that in public speaking engagements, I've said we're in the middle of a golden period for Black art. We're in the middle of a renaissance. However, I also have to remind myself that when I say that, I am thinking of the Harlem Renaissance. And as we know, the Harlem Renaissance, it was a finite period of time. You know, once the Great Depression happened, a lot of what made Black art in vogue in mainstream settings, it took a backseat in terms of just promotion, marketing, and funding. And so even though I agree with you that there was an explosion of Black art that we're seeing centered and mainstream, I just hope that it is not a trend. I hope it is something that lasts indefinitely.
To ask just like a really basic question about that too, though, you know, because I don't want to... Does it matter? You know, I mean, not thinking for a minute about the creators themselves, but if we are in fact having this Black driven art moment and all these mediums, do you think has it thus far done anything to change the way all of us think or act in society? I know that's a large question, but I just throw it out to you as a Black artist. How do you think it's affected us so far?
I agree with you in that I'm seeing Black people get book deals in the figures that probably was not possible 10, 15 years ago. I'm seeing more chic TV shows with Black faces. I'm seeing more experimental storytelling, like Michaela Cole's I May Destroy You. I mean, wow. You know what I mean? But at the same time, I do feel like there are still disparities happening. I just saw something today by one of the creators of Raising Kanan. It's part of the Power Universe by 50 Cent. He made a long post on Instagram talking about how this show, which, by the way, I watched myself, it's stellar in terms of the plot, the pacing, and the acting. Only two publications reviewed it. Two. And why is that? Because there's obviously an audience for it. There's a hashtag. I've seen it. Still, there are certain stories that are out there, but is it getting the proper promotion? Because promotion is everything.
Right.
You know, if you don't have the backing behind that to know people that this exists, they're not going to know where to look, you know? So I think that there's still much, much work to be done, not only in terms of who's getting the deals closed, but what type of support is being thrown behind them to sustain them in the industry.
Yeah. Let's bring a caller right in. Adrian in the East Village. Adrian, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I was calling to say what inspired me the most was the show of Alice Neal at the Metropolitan Museum. She did mostly portrait painting, and she covered a huge range of people, very diverse. And she wasn't recognized until she was in her late 60s, but that didn't stop her. She worked at home. She had kids. She was involved in progressive politics. And it was just very inspiring. And also, it's great to see a lot of Black artists getting their due. You know, some are already established, but I think people are becoming more aware of it, and it's wonderful.
Thank you for that, Adrian. I also saw the Alice Neal exhibit. I have to say, you know, it's funny. One of my sort of big inspirations throughout the pandemic was just New York's art museums, period. Once we, with the timed entry and the control of the number of people who were able to go in, I was able to actually see the art for the first time in a long time. I got to where I would go to MoMA, I would go to the Met, I would go to the Jacob Lawrence room at MoMA and just be able to stand with that Great Migration series and not have a million people around me and able to actually bring it in. I thank you, Adrian. I also was moved by Alice Neal. Morgan, you mentioned Michaela Cole and her show, I May Destroy You. So one of the Emmys were last weekend, and, you know, at least in my circles, the big moment was Michaela Cole's speech after she won the award for outstanding writing in a limited series for that show.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to play a little bit of that speech. Take a listen.
Write the tale that scares you, that makes you feel uncertain, that isn't comfortable. I dare you. In a world that entices us to browse through the lives of others to help us better determine how we feel about ourselves, and to, in turn, feel the need to be constantly visible. For visibility these days seems to somehow equate to success. Do not be afraid to disappear from it, from us, for a while, and see what comes to you in the silence.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what your reaction to that speech was. I was so moved by this idea that we need to be willing to disappear in a creative economy and capitalism, period, where it just puts such primacy on visibility and being constantly seen. Mm-hmm. I mean, as you point out earlier, if you do work and you don't have publicity, no one notices it. I just wonder what you as a creator thought about that speech.
Well, two things. I think that what she said about writing would scare you, I tell people that all the time. That I tell people that all the time, and she is working in a tradition of many people, many writers that say that if you are afraid of writing something, more than likely that is the thing that you're supposed to be writing, because it's probably the most heartfelt and it's probably the most honest and probably the most heartrending too. But to your point about disappearing, I think that in the age of digital media, that is so profound, because social media sort of, it's addicting. I admit it myself. And there's so many times where myself and others want to reveal a lot about ourselves, our interior lives, our processes when it comes to creating our own work, the pitfalls and all that. And sometimes it's okay to not share anything. It's okay to create this cocoon for ourselves, that as we're still attempting to get to where we want to go, we just keep it private, you know? So I think for her to say, hey, you know, it's okay to disappear and be in the silence and find out what is going to meet you there, I think that that is extraordinary.
because of also what you just said, a lot of times we're just taught to work, work, work. And I think that's what's been inspiring for me about the pandemic is that many Americans and hopefully many people around the world are understanding that you cannot attach your personhood to labor and that grinding until you die is not exemplary. It's not something that should be, it's not something that should be replicated. So I think this idea of silence and disappearing and just cocooning oneself, especially during a time like this, is not only inspiring, but I think it's necessary.
I'm talking with Morgan Jerkins, novelist and senior culture editor for The Undefeated. We'll take a break and come back to take more of your calls. We'll be right back.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, like there are urgent things happening in the world, but all you hear is noise. That's where What Next comes in, a daily news show we love from Slate. They tell you the stories you haven't heard before or a different side to the stories you thought you already knew. Join host Mary Harris every day as she cuts through the noise so that together we can all figure out what next. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright, and that is a shape note version of our theme song. Hat tip to our former producer, Jessica Miller, who was a shape note singer herself, and to composer Hannes Brown. I had never heard of a shape note. So anyway, pretty cool. I'm talking with Morgan Jerkins, who is senior culture editor for The Undefeated and author of two books, not one, but two books in the course of the pandemic. Her most recent is the novel Call Baby, which came out this spring. And we are taking your calls. Let's go to Lori in Chelsea. Lori, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Well, I read the book, The Sacred Path of the Warrior by Pema Chodron. And I think I was searching for something. I really, at the time, between family issues and just what was going on when COVID started, and it changed my life because it brought me into some pretty heady Buddhist studies, but I can't recommend it enough. The Sacred Path of the Warrior. One, once you start talking about Buddhism, about impermanence, which is something we all need to keep in mind about where we are right now is not where we're going to be, even the next second. And then this book was so strengthening about being a warrior and having, and how you need to go through life as a warrior and that pain exists and it's part of living the best life. And that had a huge influence and changed my life.
Thank you for that, Lori. That's strong praise that changed her life. Let's go to Mercedes in Forest Hills. Mercedes, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Kai. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
I actually have been going to the theater a lot as we come out of, as Broadway reopens and we come out of quarantine. And I went to see the opening night of American Utopia. And David Byrne, you know, said some things from the stage that then he went back and said, you know, that's from the original line. And it takes on a whole new meaning a year and a half later. And it, going to the theater now feels like a very communal experience. Mm. The audience is just so in the moment. and this feeling of, you know, we're coming back. The house lights went down and everybody broke into applause. The curtain goes up and everybody goes nuts applauding. And I went to see Hadestown right after it opened, and it was right after Ida. And so many lines kind of took on a different meaning, like when start talking about the rain that never ends, and you could just feel this ripple of recognition going to the audience. And when they made a toast about, you know, for, you know, here's to the world that we dream about and to the world as we live in it now. And it is a real sense of the audience having a recognition and a feeling. And, you know, we're definitely looking at these works differently after the experience that we've had.
Thank you for that, Mercedes. I also saw American Utopia. I actually streamed it over the course of the pandemic. And it's a show, it's funny, that's a show I probably would not have watched. But the pandemic had me at home looking for things to watch. And it was, it really blew up my heart. So I'm glad I watched it. But Morgan, what about theater? You know, it is, as I'm suggesting there, one of my great joys as a New Yorker. There's much more to it than Broadway out there. But this is a historic Broadway season. There will be seven shows by Black playwrights. And for perspective, folks, that it is not at all uncommon for there to be zero such shows in a season. The show Passover, written by Antoinette Nwandu, was the first play to open on Broadway this season. It's gotten critical acclaim, though. It's going to have a short run, I believe. So you got to see it soon if you want to catch it. But I think you know the show, and I think you know Antoinette Nwando's work. What's she dealing with there that you would want to call attention to?
Well, I think the premise is eye-catching for me because it's about these two characters. Their names are Moses and Kitch. And, you know, they're just chopping it up, you know. Well, I'll translate that. They're just talking, you know, and, you know, they're thinking about, you know, plans, and they're dreamers, right? And somebody sort of infiltrates their space and kind of derails whatever it is they're conjuring up. And I think that that's so interesting, you know. I love stories about dreamers. And I know that Antoinette has been working for a very long time. And so I think that all the critical acclaim that she's receiving and the spotlight are all well-deserved.
Right. Sort of on the other emotional end, I think, of those seven Black written shows is Douglas Lyon's Chicken and Biscuits, which is going to be moving from off-Broadway. It's a feel-good comedy. I haven't seen it, but it's billed as a feel-good comedy. And it's got kind of a feel-good backstory, as I understand it. Douglas Lyons apparently just pitched it a ton of times until the producer finally gave him a shot to move it to Broadway this season. What about that show? Are you excited to see it, or have you seen it? What are your thoughts on it?
I haven't seen it, but that's another one that the premise seems hilarious, about family coming together in the wake of someone's death. And I mean, there's Black films that deal with this, and all types of hijinks occur. Thinking about the movie Kingdom Come, I don't know if you've seen it, but it came out years ago, but I watched it. There's another movie I watched during the pandemic, and I could not get over how hilarious it was. So it definitely was a balm to my soul. And I'm sure that Chicken and Biscuits will be a balm to other people as well.
Yeah, and this time. But, you know, I mean, the thing about it, I've heard a number of these writers say, or I've read some of these writers say that are coming out on Broadway this year, that, you know, it's also a hard moment, that, you know, it would be the hardest season in the history of Broadway. And this is the season when all of these Black playwrights get a shot. And it begs the question of whether they're being set up for success or set up for failure. And I just wanted to throw that to you and see what you think about it. Do we need to care about that?
Oh, yes. We need to watch each and every one of these shows closely. And I'm not just saying watch them closely as in watch all of them and then see what the reviews say. I think we have to be a little bit more surgical with regards to how these shows are being touted. So, for example, who is reviewing these shows? Are they all white people? And the white people that review these shows, do they know Black people in their regular life? And because my concern is that, let's say, God forbid, all of these shows fail. then it makes it that much harder for the next round of Black playwrights to get their spot on Broadway. And it's not going to be because of this round of Black playwrights' fault, but because of the other systemic elements in place. And that's not just with regards to funding and marketing promotion, as we mentioned earlier in the segment, but also regards to who is reviewing Black art. Are Black people able to review Black art? And that's not to say, and I just want to put it out there, that's not to say that white people can't critique Black art. But we have to ask ourselves, for the white people that do critique Black art, do they consume Black art anywhere else in their life? Do they commune with other Black people in their regular lives in an intimate, non-transactional way? And I think that that is something that I'm going to be interested in knowing as these shows come out, because I'm proud of each and every one of these people. But that's a lot of pressure for them. And it's not just on them if these shows succeed or not. It takes a village. And that's not only applies to a child, or though a lot of artists will metaphorically say that their work is their child, right? But it applies to things like this as well. Who's getting the shine? Who is critiquing these works? What is the promotion like for these particular works? And that's how we really get the ball rolling and be able to gauge and assess these stories in their rightful context.
Let's go to Demone in Bed-Stuy. I think I pronounced that correctly. Demone, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. And I just want to say that I agree so very much with the sentiments of your guests. I think that, yes, it is important that we look at, and we as Black people, that we look at things that mirror us. But I also want to say this. Don't give me junk and think that I'm just going to watch it. Quality stuff, and I'm going to watch it. But the point that I called about was the show that I have been watching, or during the COVID, during the lockdown, I discovered Curb Your Enthusiasm. And it made me, I have to tell you, it made me okay with being that old man, that old Black man on the street, or on that block, who was like, excuse me, pick this up, or, you know what, can you move your car, because it's alternate street parking. I have a sycamore tree. All year long, it loses branches, it loses leaves. And if you park there, that's just more for me to sweep up. And how would you like if I just took all these leaves and all this bark and put them in front of your door? So please move the car. So sorry, so you can't double park right there because you're blocking somebody in. So it's absolutely fine. So thank you. And you enjoy the rest of your day. And you guys stay safe and you stay healthy.
Thank you so much for that. All right. So Larry David has helped him be his true self. What are you looking forward to? We've talked about TV a little bit. We've talked about theater. What about books? You're a writer. What are you looking forward to that's coming that you're eager to read? I mean, particularly thinking about stuff that's going to help us get through this next period together.
Well, I have read Nobody's Magic by Destiny Birdsong, and it's a triptych of a book. So it's three stories about albino Black women from Louisiana. The language is so rich. The language is rich. The way that Destiny describes the atmosphere, it's very visceral, and I loved it. I definitely just gobbled all of it up. That is a book that I'm looking forward to. Another book is Another Appalachia by Nima Avashia, Avashia. And she is a queer Indian woman from, you guessed it, Appalachia. And what she writes about that part of society, which is oftentimes sort of narrowed to deleterious stereotypes to those who are not from there, oftentimes overlooked. And she broadens the scope, not only because of the identity and the body that she inhabits, but also the people that she interacts with, the ways in which her neighborhood has evolved over the years, and also, you know, her political reckoning and moving away, coming back, all those sorts of things. And so those are two books that I'm looking forward to the rest of the public reading.
We have about a minute left, Morgan. What in terms of the takeaways for this fall season as things are coming down the pike, what do you think it's going to tell us about ourselves?
Oh, we have so much work to do. I think the hardest part for me, and I've spoken about it with friends, is that it's hard to stay soft. It's hard to stay compassionate. Mm. And I think that's hard when you see over 600,000 American lives lost. It's hard to stay that way when politicians, the lawmakers fail and, you know, disappoint you. It's hard to stay soft and compassionate when you have things like the abortion ban in Texas. Or just the other day, I read, you know, there were teens from Missouri High School arguing, circling a petition that asked for slavery to come back.
Wow.
I think that as the weather cools down and we brace ourselves for what the Delta or the Lambda or the Gamma variant is going mm-hmm. to do to us again as a society, I think that the challenge is going to be to remain soft and to remain compassionate and to remind ourselves that it's not about us and it never was about us. That individualism as fueled by capitalism failed us and that we have to be a collective in order to imagine a new normal, not the normal that we were grinding towards before the pandemic.
We'll have to leave it there. Morgan Jerkins is the senior culture editor at ESPN's Undefeated, and her latest book is Call Baby, which was released in April. So glad to have had you, Morgan, and thanks to everybody who called and tweeted at us. If you didn't get in, we'd still want to hear from you. Chime in, send me a voice memo at anxiety@wnyc.org. And up next, we're going to take a closer look at one TV show that really stuck to the bones of some of us who make this program. We'll talk with writer Ashley C. Ford about the HBO series Lovecraft Country. Stay with us.
Hey everyone, it's Kusha. I'm a producer. Last week, our episode was about climate change, and we got a bunch of great voicemails from you, so thank you. Here's one of them, from a listener with a call to action that she's implementing in her life. And quick plug, if you want to talk to us, send us a voicemail. We love getting them. The address is anxiety@wnyc.org. All right, here it is.
Hi, this is Jordy from the South Village calling. I just want to say that the solutions that were mentioned on the and discussed on the program were all about what government and industry and banking could do. What was ignored was the simple thing that every individual can do, and that is to change the way you eat. The animal agriculture industry causes deforestation, tremendous water use, and a lot of waste products. Every individual can make a difference. You don't have to be able to ride a bike to work. You don't have to lobby your government, although all of those things are important. But individually, you can make a difference. Change what you eat. It's good for the earth. It's good for your body. It's great for the environment. Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright. Last fall, we on this team were kind of obsessed with the HBO show Lovecraft Country. It didn't win any Emmys, but it's back in our minds after the tragic death of Michael K. Williams. His character was, as always, a brilliantly tortured soul. For those who missed the show, it was a sci-fi horror series about a black family in the middle 20th century that discovers literal monsters alongside the everyday white power monsters in their lives. And they have to kind of summon magic in order to survive. For our executive producer, Verlyn Williams, the show was her escape route from the real life horrors of 2020. HBO made a podcast to accompany the show that was called Lovecraft Country Radio. And it was hosted by the writer and thinker Ashley C. Ford. So Verlyn spoke with her at the end of the show's run, and they talked about radical black love, unapologetic anger, and real-life horror stories. Here's their conversation.
You have to think about the fact that the first film ever screened at the White House was Birth of a Nation, right? Horror and racism and the indomitable spirit are baked into the foundation of what America is. So right now, as we try to figure out what the soul of America, the United States of America, what the soul of that is, what it looks like in the daylight without the cover of night, when we bring these monsters and these horrors into view, what do we see? How big are they? How scary are they? Can we beat them? Are we gonna do it? Are we gonna make it? Is the nightmare over? Is the nightmare just beginning? Is there a sequel? Only the future can tell, right? All of those questions are up for debate right now, just as they would be in any good plot of any good horror movie.
So, you know, you've described yourself as a horror enthusiast and you've tweeted in the past about wanting to write your own horror movie.
Oh, yeah.
Where does your relationship with the genre and horror come from?
Horror was a really great place to learn how to process fear. Because it becomes very apparent to you when you're a kid who likes horror that you're either going to have to stop watching this stuff or you're going to have to figure out what to do with your fear and where to put it so that it doesn't sit on top of you and keep you up all night. I think even before I could really verbalize it, something in me realized I was learning something from horror emotionally. I was learning how to do something with my fear.
Was this modeled for you in any on any level?
When I lived in Missouri with my grandmother for a year, we went to the movies every Saturday. And we used to sit through the credits because she wanted to read all the credits after a movie finished. And you start to realize like, oh yeah, people make this. They don't go out and film it as it's happening and then make a movie out of it. It's like somebody came up with an idea. Somebody created this monster. A makeup artist came in and turned the person into a monster using makeup and movie magic, you know, and stuff like that. And just the dissection of what was happening there, you can't be super scared of a monster when you see them sitting in the makeup chair and getting their makeup done and stuff like that. And so I think that that's sort of what my grandmother modeled for me was like, this is all story. This is all art. And it makes you feel a certain way. But if you stick around long enough, you get to see that it's made up of many, many pieces and not just some great source of evil.
You know, in the world of Lovecraft, there are many terrifying monsters we've seen in horror movies forever. Ghosts, witches, wizards, giant, bug-eyed, vampire-adjacent, carnivorous, four-legged creatures.
Oh, yeah.
And police officers, right? And in 2020, anyone living at the intersection of any combination of race, class, gender, immigration status, on and on, are living with the same undeniable fear that the main characters in Lovecraft are grappling with. And so as someone, you, who is living at the intersection of a few of these things yourself, like what's been your experience like watching it and working on Lovecraft Radio?
You know, this is because there, like there's more intersections than like you would even know. Like as a Black woman, as an artist, as a person in this country right now, as a person who has both police officers and felons in her family, you know what I mean? Like direct relations. What this show has done for me that I think a lot of people have appreciated well beyond me is that it has never pretended that you won't be dealing with all those things at the same time. And those things that we should be focused on are never ending. there's always something we're not talking enough about. There's always something falling through the cracks. There's always something missing. And the truth is that that's real. That is the absolute truth. Just like we see with Dee in episode 8 of Lovecraft Country.
Letty, where's Tick?
I don't know.
When's he coming back?
I don't know, Diana. Go inside. Call your uncle. Tell him you're here.
Wait. Letty?
What?
Behind you, there's...
You okay?
That's one of my favorite episodes because it shows that we're losing things through the cracks. Like, we're losing people, we're losing lives, we're losing kids, we're losing hope, we're losing faith all the time. And at the same time, we're moving toward something new and different. And we're always being pulled toward the future, whatever the future may be. And we do get to set some intention in what we want that future to look like. And we do get to decide just enough in our days to decide what kind of person we want to be in that future. Even when that's really, really, really hard to remember.
And then also, at a time where it feels like life keeps happening to us, would you agree that Lovecraft Country is a reminder that we do have power?
Yeah. This show is constantly making me think about power. It's constantly making me think about the little bit of power I have and the responsibility that I have because of that power. Because if there's one thing this show has shown me, as much as the world has shown it to me over the course of my life, it's that... The problem is not always that there is power. The problem is that we have limited definitions of power. We only think of power over and not power to or shared power.
Mm-hmm. And so thinking about like magic as a metaphor for power, as Lovecraft has set up, like why is magic useful? Why is magic and quite frankly, why is horror useful for thinking about all of this, you know?
I think horror is useful because horror is essentially about hope and the indomitable human spirit. Because when you watch a horror film, what makes it interesting is the idea that somebody might make it to the end. At least one person might make it to the end. If they don't, still a horror film. But the reason you watched it was to see if they were gonna make it. You know, and you have to be cognizant, I think, at all times of the fact that like white supremacy, if you wanna go there, and like white supremacy really is like the biggest monster.
The lie of white supremacy.
Yes. Even the people it affects, it infects, right? Like growing up in that environment, some of it is there in you. You have been taught and corrected in the ways of white supremacy. You absolutely have. And this show is not just about what it does to you to be affected by it and infected by it. It also talks about the ways that you can try to use it and it backfires or it works. Because we are still having the conversation long after the question has been asked, you know, whether or not the master's tools will dismantle the master's house. Will they? Will they really? We have to keep asking ourselves.
So far, I feel like the answer is no. Like, how does that inform? Like, how do you think about that for your own life?
The master's tools, I do not think, will dismantle the master's house. But I do think that what is left of the master's house may be useful. Maybe there's something in the rubble. And it is going to have to be transformed and reimagined, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think that. Other times I think, burn it all down and sweep it all out the door. Never look back. We're just gonna clean slate, start something new and go forward. But I don't think you can do that. Like, you can't clean slate. We carry so much already in our blood and in our histories and in the stories we tell each other about the world versus the stories that are true about the world. Our identities, like, there's so much there that people have to be able to deal with. And nobody really wants to hear that. Mm-hmm. Like, people don't really want to hear that not being able to deal with something emotionally actually affects their lives.
There's a way in which, you know, even in Lovecraft and in our own lives, our families have made so many sacrifices for us, right? So that, you know, mm-hmm. they're not living their full lives for us, for our future. And now we're in the future making sacrifices. Like, when do we get to, like, just cash in? Like, when do we just get to, like, be the fulfillment of the sacrifice?
I don't know when we get that. You know, that's the hard thing, is that I truly believe that the worst thing that happens to children are the unlived lives of their parents. Mm. And they have been handed down the unlived lives of their parents, who were handed down the unlived lives of their parents. And that's just not how we were made to survive or thrive. It's not.
How did you get to that understanding? Like, where does your deep understanding of that come from?
None of it worked. Mm. None of it worked. I know what it's like to be a workaholic. I know what it's like to be a person who is on their hustle and on their grind constantly, who comes from nothing and is just trying to be a good person while reaching for something better for themselves whenever they can, trying to, like, snatch a little piece of happiness, thinking that sleep is for weak people, thinking that needing love is for weak people, like all of those things. Like, I know what it's like to be the person who hardcore goes, feelings shouldn't matter. Mm. Like, it just shouldn't. How can feelings matter when you need to survive? And lo and behold, they kept mattering. They kept affecting me. There were times when the difference between me being able to eat or not eat was whether or not I got up and, like, out of a depression and, like, got myself to a job that I hated, and I couldn't do it. I didn't think it was real that you could be that sad, you could be that hurt, you could be that traumatized, that you lost what felt like lost control of your will. Mm. I didn't think it was real until it happened to me. Oh. Because nobody around me ever affirmed in any way that that could be real. Everyone around me made me think that if you could in any way be affected by your feelings that strongly, something was wrong with you. I tried 5 million different ways to pull myself up by my bootstraps. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work until I started taking care of myself and realizing that my feelings were not obstacles to my productivity. Mm-hmm. They were information about who I was and what I wanted.
I mean, one thing I've been saying a lot in this 2020 racial pandemic, you know, COVID, is that I have to actively choose joy for my survival. Like, I have to, like, actively. And I think when I say that, you know, on social media, hashtag choose joy, some people might look at it and roll their eyes and be like, okay, good for you. But it's like, no, it doesn't mean that it's easy. Like, no. It's like, literally, it's hard for me to get out of bed. And then I, like... Yes. Think about something that brings me joy, and then I'm like, okay, let's do it. You know, it's like a choice.
But a lot of people, and I understand because I was the same way, a lot of people are not in a position where they even really have the access or the resources to make that choice, to be able to really practice cultivating joy for yourself. I mean, I think of it as necessary. I think of it as incredibly
so
healing.
Yes.
But I am so aware of the privilege I have in being able to even engage in the practice of it. Because I grew up around people who, where would they have had the time, space, or energy to practice cultivating joy. What? Like, what does that even mean? Right? And so I try to be really respectful. Like, I'm never telling people, like, you know, if you got problems, it's your fault. Cause really, you should get some therapy. You should start meditating and you got to start cultivating some joy in your life. You know, like, I'm not telling people that because I don't know their life. Yeah. I don't know what they have. Like, I know that if you have the time and space and you can do it, if you have what you need to invest in yourself in that way, I really hope you go for it. And I don't hope you go for it because I'm like, you should do that. Mm-hmm. I hope you go for it because it feels great eventually. If you're really in the practice of it, eventually, and you know this, it feels so good when you feel bad and you know what you need to feel better. This is a time, I think, of great intention if you have the time and the will to gather you some intention and point it in the right direction. Like, now is the time to do that. That power, that magic is everywhere right now. It is in the air, and we see it. We see the evidence of how quickly things can change. We see the evidence of, like, when we've built up these invisible institutions and systems that we think to ourselves, that's the way it's got to be. And somebody came in and just said, I'm not doing that. And now that's not the way it is. You know what that creates? A little bit of magic. Not because it was the right thing to do, don't get me wrong, but because what it does is it plants a seed of imagination. Mm. The potential to plant a seed of imagination is there. You can do two things with finding out the world is not the way you thought it was. You can despair or you can imagine. And so I think this is a great time of imagination.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Mixing and music by Jared Paul. Kevin Bristow and Milton Ruiz were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Froman, and Kusha Navidar. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. And this is the final episode in which I can say Verilyn Williams is our executive producer. Verilyn is moving on to greener pastures, and we will deeply, deeply miss her. And I'm Kai Wright. So you can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright or send me a voice memo by email at anxiety@wnyc.org. And as always, join us for the live show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at wnyc.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Till then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.